CB Shocking Jazz.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet, I mean clap your heads.
Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
Live from the CRN Studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this is Racing Through History.
Welcome to this edition of the Goat Rodeo. My name's Jeff Gilder, and I'll see if I can guide you through this thing tonight. Hope everybody's fine. It's been a while since we've been here, but we're back. They said we would be. It was true. Here we are. We're living proof. I'm going to turn this over to the fellas out in the booth and let them say howdy to you while I get the stream set up on a couple more pages. So, hey, Coastal Jack, take it away, buddy.
All right, man, I'm glad to be back in the studio. It's been a long dry spell. It's almost like the off season in NASCAR or something. I mean, good gosh, it's been a while. But anyway, I'm happy to be back here tonight, and got a Carolina Race Place historic race finish coming up a little bit later. So what's up, Bobby?
Well, there's a lot has gone on since we've been absent. The NASCAR season has ended. The big Myrtle Beach race has come and gone. The Snowball Derby. There's the Bell and Bell season has ended and has our own banquet. So,
yep,
quite a lot of news in the off season.
Lots of stuff to digest. The end of the NASCAR season. The end of the Bell and Bell season. I guess has Myrtle Beach ended, Jack?
Their season is
over with also. So now we have to digest all of the comings and goings of all of the teams and drivers and sponsors and retirees, and looks like we got quite a few this year to mull over and see what's on the horizon for next year.
Jack, did you watch the NASCAR banquet?
I did not.
That makes three of us.
I mean, years ago, I used to watch it and wait for it to come on.
Oh, yeah.
In the last 4 or 5 years, I haven't even watched it.
Have the VCR set and record all of it. I remember doing that.
I mean,
that.
You know, that's when guys like Tim Richmond would come out after having several beers and, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, I used to watch it religiously. It would be on a Friday night,
yep,
early December, like it was. But this time it was a Thursday night, which is kind of, I guess, kind of an offbeat night in a way. But Thursday night. But this year, I didn't watch it, but you couldn't help. But this was all over social media everywhere. Was the great ring presentation by BZF to Martin Truex. Did you see that? I'm sure you've seen and read the recount.
I've seen part of that.
I didn't see it the first or second time or the 50th time, but it sounded like from some of the recounts that I've had of it that it was just a, here's your ring, and walk away.
That's pretty much what it, I mean, I didn't see it either, but just, you know, reading the accounts of it, that's read one grassy knoll theory that was all part of the master plan, that it kind of drew attention off of what might be obvious onto BZ, but that might be giving him a bit more
more credit than he deserves.
Well, but as hard as they worked all year to make sure that he won it, it doesn't, you know. Why not a little more hoopla? I don't know.
I think it was phenomenal that he won it. I don't like Toyotas, but I think, you know, when you're running a race team out of Denver, Colorado, and win the championship,
even if you
had some help, that's still
with
something.
Somebody else's engine.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And somebody else, and a rented pit crew.
Yeah, a rental crew. And he sort of...
Some of that crew was obviously under the auspices of Joe Gibbs.
Yep, I think this year, when he was with Chevrolet, it was out of Richard Childress' shop. But apparently, there's a lot of that goes on, you know, you just don't hear about.
Yeah. The
Or was it Michael Waltrip's shop that he had the crew from last year or the year before? One of those two.
Yeah, and somebody had a crew for Michael Waltrip because Michael Waltrip ended up with a folded team.
Yeah.
So he had a over-the-wall crew for rent.
But, you know, NASCAR is pretty big business, whether we like some of the stuff that goes on the track or not. I mean, it's a business.
It is that, and it has many, many, many moving parts.
Yep.
When you think about what they put on almost on a weekly basis – and do it all over the United States, to put on a basketball or a football game is a pretty big operation. But to put on something with as many moving pieces as a NASCAR race, that's phenomenal. That takes a lot of practice, a lot of effort, and a lot of coordination that the John Q. public never sees, never thinks about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a lot different putting on a basketball game or a football game that's a 100-yard field compared to a 2.33-mile racetrack or 2.66-mile.
Plus the fact that you, instead of having two teams, now you've got 40 teams.
Mm-hmm.
And all the equipment that it takes to put a car on the track, much less 40 cars on the track, and a lot of them, if you look – there's so few fans around now, sometimes they're parking those extra rigs on the infield, and you look and you see 30 or 40 tractor trailers parked in the infield. They're just nondescript. They're full of parts and pieces and stuff that the teams haul with them from track, just spares, just stuff that they might need.
It's kind of like Bell and Bell.
Yeah, we haul all that stuff.
We haul stuff too, but
that we might not.
Yeah, all on an open trailer.
Yeah. Stuff it all in the back of the race car and hope it doesn't blow out.
Yeah. Well, curiously, there was no mention one way or the other of Monster and their updating or re-upping or signing, extending the contract, however you want to
term it,
at the NASCAR banquet. That was sort of a curious, conspicuous by its lack of a presence. So the theory was maybe Brian ran off the stage to kind of draw attention from the fact that there wasn't
they didn't have any announcement to make about the re-up of their sponsor. Of course, a lot of the teams apparently are having the same problem. The sponsors leaving or moving or altering their sponsorship.
Well, the reason you sponsor something is to reach people.
Right.
To reach customers, potential customers.
Potential customers.
And if the base that's watching the race in person or on TV is going down, you know, it's worth less money.
If your product is not selling, not improving in sales, then maybe you're spending your sponsorship dollars in the wrong way.
Yeah.
I won't say wrong place, but maybe just in the wrong way. That's always been a really big moving target when you stop to think about it. And with the apparent fade of NASCAR's popularity, it has to eat into the potential for people who would buy the sponsor's product. That's, any wonder that the sponsorship dollars are waning.
NASCAR continually makes the argument that TV viewing numbers are really irrelevant or kind of meaningless because one thing they use is, well, everybody's numbers down, you know, not just ours, but sports in general. Which may be true, and then the other part is, well, people get their information now more on various, you know, handhelds and social media and so on and so forth. There's no denying that that's true. I mean, there's a degree of truth there that people do watch through various other means, but there's no way to measure that or somehow charge for. I mean, that doesn't help a potential. That doesn't help Monster Energy. The fact that you can explain why people ain't watching still doesn't move the needle. We want, you know,
we want sales. We want viewers.
Yeah, we're paying you for people to watch. You know, it don't help us to you to explain why they ain't watching.
Personally, I think Monster Energy has been soft pedaled all year. I mean, I don't think they're getting near the exposure they thought they were getting. You know, even watching the broadcast, they don't mention Monster Energy very much. Some of the newscasts that have racing call it the NASCAR Cup or the NASCAR Championship, not the Monster Energy. Right.
Well, you know, they made a name, and maybe it was semantical, maybe they were looking down the road, but it's actually the Monster Energy NASCAR Cup Series.
Exactly.
Which sort of opens the door that if Monster's no longer there, we can just plug in somebody else.
Yeah.
And it will still be the blah, blah, blah NASCAR Cup Series.
It's also too long for broadcasters and people like that.
It was hard for me to convert from NASCAR to the Winston Cup. But after the light bulb finally came on, it finally sunk in that's what it was. It actually came off the tongue better than the NASCAR way of putting their name out there. And everything that they did, that Reynolds Tobacco Company did from day one until they got out of it, was Winston Cup. And every racetrack had red and white checkered walls, and the outhouses were painted red and white.
In the early Winston era, they had sort of divided the season into three components. Remember that? There was a third, a third, and a third. Who was leading at such? Yep. I don't remember what the prizes or if any was awarded, but they sort of had which that didn't last very long. But I remember the early version of Winston Cup was they had these mid season at least. Kind of mini series or something, kind of like stage racing now. Except,
but you know, occasionally you still hear somebody refer to it as Winston Cup, even today.
Yeah,
and I hear more people refer to the second series as the Busch Series.
As the Busch Series, yes.
That has stuck well.
And I'm wondering,
and they're on their third title sponsor since then.
Exactly.
I'm wondering if it may become the Busch Series again. Have you noticed how much Busch beer has advertised on the Xfinity series this year, which kind of makes me wonder if maybe Anheuser-Busch may not be coming back to the second series or something else. I don't know.
Who knows?
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to, like everybody else, we'll just have to sit on the sidelines and wait and see what. Or if we have a title sponsor for 19.
Yeah. Of course, this past weekend we had the 50th annual Snowball Derby down in Pensacola, Florida, which was a huge success.
So when was
complete
50 years
sellout.
Ago? 1967 or 68? Was that the first one?
Yeah, I think it was 67. I'm not positive. But that was a sellout. And then there was a pay-per-view broadcast, and I have no idea what the numbers were there, but it was worth them doing it for the third year, I think, in a row. So, obviously, they're getting viewership.
And that is not NASCAR.
No, that
sanctioned.
Is not. Although at one time it was. I think when NASCAR had it, NASCAR. What did they call the All Pro Series after NASCAR bought it?
All American. Yeah. I think.
I think for a couple of years, the Snowball Derby was the All American, 200 at the time. Of course, today it is the 300 laps on the half-mile paved track.
How is that? Do they have a midpoint break, or they make pit stops under green, or how do they do that?
Green flag stops. They did have a rule if they went 75 laps without a caution flag, they would throw a caution let them change tires or whatever. But it was a pit crew. You had to have a pit crew. And I think a lot of them rented Cup or Xfinity pit crews.
Really?
That's big deal.
Well, there.
And Kyle Busch won, by the way.
Did he?
He brought three cars down there.
In the pit crew division, he was head and shoulders. His knowledge of what pit crew's supposed to do and how to do it would be better than the rest of those guys.
I suppose. I don't know, because other guys could rent pit crews also, and Kyle Busch never led a lap to, 18, 20 laps to go. Bubba Pollard was led for a lot, and some other guys. So it was a pretty good race.
Yeah, that puts a whole other dynamic into it.
That race needs to be on everybody's bucket list. Luckily, I've been once and thoroughly enjoyed it.
It was a couple of years ago that Chase Elliott was they disqualified him for
some weights,
an exotic metal. I'm trying to remember what it was.
Tungsten, yeah.
Yeah, he actually won the race, didn't he?
Yep. Well, there's been several winners over the years been disqualified because they have a very strict tech inspection after the race, with the winning cars, the winning car. And it's pretty cool.
Then they had excellent weather.
Yeah, beautiful weather. Yeah.
Well, all right, let's do that Carolina race place historically.
Oh, we can do it. And just so happens, since I didn't have a whole lot of time to put something together, I pulled out a Snowball Derby one.
Oh, cool.
So we actually did this one time before, but we're going to repeat it tonight. We're going to go back to 1974, Five Flag Speedway in Pensacola, Florida. At that time, it was a 200-lap late model sportsman race. Promoter Tom Dawson started the annual Snowball Derby, here's your answer, Bobby, in 1968. It has always been held in early December. Wayne Nidecken won the first Snowball Derby race in 1968. Over the next 5 years, the annual event was also won by Friday Hassler, Wayne Nidecken for a second time, Dickie Davis, Ed Howe, and Dickie Davis again. The 1970 Daytona 500 winner, Pete Hamilton, ended his six-year driving career at NASCAR's highest level in 1973. Hamilton moved to Atlanta area, opened a shop building late model sportsman cars. He also drove what he built in races around the Southeast. He took one of his Chevelles to Pensacola in 1973 for the Snowball Derby and won the pole position. He was forced by officials to make changes to a suspension setup on his car just before the 73 race. The officials said it fell outside of the rules. He didn't run very well in the 1973 race, finished 35th, but vowed to be back for revenge in 1974. That brings us up to the December 8th, 1974 event, which was held on a cold, cloudy Sunday. Totally different than this past weekend. Pete Hamilton again won the pole position in 1974 with a lap of 18.14 seconds around the half-mile paved oval. When the race started, Neil Bonnett, driving a car owned by Bobby Allison, took the lead. On the eighth lap, Pete Hamilton passed Bonnett to go to the number one spot. Hamilton drove away from the field until making a pit stop on lap 146. Dickie Davis took over the lead on lap 41. On lap 187, Bobby Allison and Darrell Waltrip got together with both cars spinning out. When the race went back to green on lap 190, after a caution flag, Pete Hamilton again went to the lead and held it to the finish. Hamilton won $4,100 for the victory from the $15,500 purse. A couple of additional notes. The 1974 race was Butch Lindley's first trip to the Snowball Derby. His crew chief on the number 116 that day was Mike Laughlin. 1 year later, in 1975, Mike Beam started working with Lindley at the 1975 race. Butch Lindley came back to the Snowball Derby seven more times before finally winning in 1984. I had a brief conversation with Butch Nelson, owner of the car driven by Dave Mader III in the 1974 race. He told me they started off good, but had engine problems and ended up finishing 30th. He also said Pete Hamilton was in another zip code that day and outclassed the field. Pete Hamilton, winner of the 1970 Daytona 500 and the 1974 Snowball Derby, died on March 21st, 2017 at the age of 74. Okay, here's the way they finished at Five Flag Speedway for the Snowball Derby, which was a 200-lap race at the time, December the 8th, 1974. The winner driving number 25, Pete Hamilton, from Devon, Massachusetts, and driving a 65 Chevelle, followed by Dickie Davis, Pensacola, Florida, Neil Bonnet, Hueytown, Alabama, Joe Richie, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Freddie Fryer, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Jackie Young, Elba, Ontario, I guess, Bobby Allison, Hueytown, Alabama, Butch Lindley, Greenville, South Carolina, Darrell Waltrip, Owensboro, Kentucky, coming in 10th, Sam Summers, Savannah, Georgia, C.L. Fisher, Dalton, Alabama, Luther Carter, Kennesaw, Georgia, Wayne Rudiman, Zephyr Hills, Florida, Richard Orton, Hueytown, Alabama, Jerry Lawley, Birmingham, Alabama, came in 15th, Tommy Martin, Bogalusa, Louisiana, Red Farmer, Hueytown, Alabama, Roy Milliken, Birmingham, Alabama, Bab Brand, Montgomery, Alabama, coming in 20th, Tiny Lund Cross, South Carolina, Hugh Richards, Mobile, Alabama, Bobby Foster, Moss Point, Mississippi, Ray Putman, Birmingham, Alabama, Skip Manning, Bogalusa, Louisiana, Ronnie Sanders came in 25th, he's from Fayetteville, Georgia, Earl Hughes, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Cecil Jones, Mobile, Alabama, Charlie Skipper, Panama City, Florida, Tommy Howe, Pleasant Grove, Alabama, Dave Mader III, Hollywood, Alabama, came in 30th, Johnny Williams, Montgomery, Alabama, Frank McMorris, Denham Springs, Louisiana, Larry Hudson, Panama City, Florida, Wayne Nidecken, Pensacola, Florida, Ray Hanner, Unadilla, Georgia, and finishing in the 36th and final spot, Royce Johnson, Flora, Alabama. So that's the way they finished. 1974, December the 8th.
A few familiar names and lots of unfamiliar names that far back.
Yep, well.
Some of them came on to be
big stars,
and some of them just sort of faded out.
Yep.
Of course, you listen to where they were from, and some of them were just locals.
Yeah.
Kind of like the Daytona crowd that showed up every year to try to make the Daytona race. And a few made it, and a lot of them practiced and qualified and went home.
The Snowball Derby's always had a huge outpouring of entries. I mean, this year I think they had 60-some entries, you know, to start 36 cars. And back in the day, so to speak, they had more than that. I think they had about 80, you know. So
have they always started just 36?
I think they've always started 36.
In the beginning, wasn't it more of a late model sportsman type of race? It's evolved into a super late model.
Yeah, yes, yes.
But back in the day, it was just regular.
Yeah, or like we said earlier with the Grand American Series, it was, you know, those type cars for a couple of years.
But I saw that picture today from 1969. It was just Chevelles and, you know, just regular late model type cars.
Yeah. But that's always been a premier short track race in this country. Kind of reminds me of the way back in the early 50s that, or mid 50s, Langhorne, Pennsylvania was to racing. You know, that was a big race. That was like the Daytona race almost back then.
It's funny how a particular race will gain notoriety and keep it for years and years and years. I guess it's just at right time, right place.
Well, when you do it right.
When you do it right. Of course, this is the right time of year to have something like the Snowball Derby. Yeah. The season's over. Everybody's kind of wishing they had something to do. Here's a chance to go run one more.
Yeah, I mean, the track's a half-mile track. Got worn-out pavement like Myrtle Beach here, actually.
Is it a weekly track?
Yes. Well, I don't know if they run every week,
but they
run throughout the season.
Right. Yep. It's not just a...
The Southern Super Series, I know, runs there. They have a couple races there. But, you know, apparently the community in Pensacola supports the Speedway very well. I think they presented them this year with some kind of tourism award and that kind of thing. So once you have the community behind you,
yeah,
that's a big help as opposed to a lot of other areas where
they're trying to shut you down.
Exactly.
I would say there is a direct relationship between community support and tracks that have been in operation a long time.
Yep.
It's much more tough to start now.
Oh, absolutely.
And gain community
virtually
support.
Impossible to start now
because you know tracks like Pensacola and other long term tracks have been there so long. It's part of local culture. Yep. People, they just naturally gravitate because that's how they were reared in the culture and so on, and that's almost impossible to attain anymore.
In this environment, it's really, really, like you said, almost impossible to generate enough interest to start something like that.
I mean, we kind of forget about right here in South Carolina, we've got one track that's been around since the beginning, just about Greenville Pickens Speedway.
Yep.
I mean, it's still kicking.
Yeah, and that is important. That's an important, an intangible that you can't get now. I mean, you just have to have it.
Well, Myrtle Beach has been in operation for a long, long time too.
Since 1958.
It's been sort of through its own metamorphosis, yep. But basically, it's been in operation pretty much the whole time, hadn't it?
It was a couple of years they did not race back in the early 70s, I believe.
And in the mid-60s, they was down three or four years.
Yeah, you're right.
Continuously.
You're right.
But for the most part, they've been there since the late 50s.
Yep.
That's a lot to be said today if a track has survived that long. We see a few of them and take them for granted, but when you see the number of tracks that have fallen by the wayside for what we think are just inconsequential little things, it's a real challenge to make one a regular event, especially on a weekly basis.
That brings up the question. I don't know that weekly basis should even be an objective anymore on a local track.
Especially if there's another one anywhere close by.
Yeah, in this environment.
I think that is. Of course, we love the idea. Well, I mean, we're but as a realistic statement, I don't know that that's attainable anymore. I'm sure that there's cases where it exists very well, but they are isolated and are rarities.
Yep. It seems like a lot of the tracks now are going. They've got a couple big races a year, and that's where they make their money. Kind of like in the old days, they had a couple Grand Nationals a year, and that's where they made their money. And subsidized everything.
Subsidized the rest of the season.
You make a good point, Jack. That in that regard, nothing's really changed. I remember when I first went to Myrtle Beach as a kid in the early 60s, they were only doing about 6-8 races a year.
Yep.
It was maybe twice a month, and they were all special events.
Yep.
And that model has sort of come back as the only one that, if it will work, that's the only one that's going to work. The weekly stuff is really not going to. It's just not plausible anymore. Whatever you make one week, you lose it the next three.
Yep.
I mean, is the reality. And the thing, the thing that's driving all this, and this is very tough, and it's affecting a sinking tide lowers all ships, you know, is that the culture, American culture, is changing.
Right.
Exactly. In regard to its love of automobiles.
Yep. Yep. I wonder what's going to happen 15 years from now when all the cars are self-driving. We're going to have self-driving races?
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody sets up in the stands and controls
with
cars
a laptop.
On the
front.
But, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but it's a very real problem. Is kids today, that they're not interested in cars.
They don't associate with it, the automobile.
Right.
When we grew up, that was our main thing. We thought about cars 20 hours a day. And you knew every make and model. You knew you knew which driver drove which brand of car. You could almost identify them hearing them come down the street. But you certainly could identify them as soon as you saw them.
Oh yeah.
And nowadays
you can't tell.
You can't. We can't tell. And today's kids don't care.
Yeah, I'm just surprised nobody has started a. SUV series or something. They all look the same.
I was flipping through the channels Saturday night and went through MAV TV, and they were having some kind of race. They were cars, and it started out on a paved, it was a closed course circuit. It was more like a road course, but at some point around the track, it became dirt. There was a dirt straightaway or a series of, you know, slaloms and jumps and mess.
Was
and
it in the U.S. or was it somewhere else? Because now Australia and places like
and
that.
And then it returned some, to pavement. I think it was some division of Rallycross. But, it incorporated everything. It was jumps and all that kind of stuff and pavement and dirt at the same time.
Well, that's trying to pull these little kids in the monster truck.
Yep. It's kind of like in the 90s that some of the tracks tried to generate interest in their version of plate racing.
Yep.
They take these front-wheel drive cars, take the rear wheels off of them,
Weld
a plate under the rear axle and said, here, drive it.
Yep. They had them out at Myrtle Beach a time or two.
Yep. I've watched it just enough of it to know how challenging that is. That sounds real simple at first blush. Just try it sometime.
Yeah, in that whole general vein, over the last part of this season, the Lakeview, Carolina Speedway at Lakeview, it had been closed for this whole year, and it looked like, for all practical purposes, that she was not going to reopen. It was kind of for sale, but that wasn't really going anywhere. There was some occasional interest, and you hear this and that, but nothing was really going anywhere. And very late in the year, they decided to host a race. I think part of that may have been driven by the fact that if you have the credentials and the permits and so on to conduct races, you have to have at least one a year to keep that those permits in place. I don't know that for a fact, but that could have been part of the reason. But anyway, the Lakeview had one. We might have discussed it here on the show over the Labor Day weekend, and it went pretty good. Had a pretty good car count and fan count and everything. And that led to a second race in November, which was actually it was the same day as the Myrtle Beach race, and I didn't realize it. I kept thinking the whole time that the Myrtle Beach 400 was going to be on Sunday, because it used to be always on Sunday.
Yeah, until they had a couple of rainouts, and they decided the best thing to do is have it on Saturday so they'd have that extra day.
I figured that they went for the built-in rain date.
Yeah. Plus, it's over two weekends the last couple of years.
But anyway, as everything turned out, the second Lakeview race was November the 18th, which is the exact same day, same time, same everything as the Myrtle Beach race, and we went. It wasn't an official Bell and Bell race. We did have a vintage race, which was the same guys, the same cars, and we run there, and had 70 race cars on hand.
Wow.
That night, which is in this era, that is good for a Saturday night race. Had a pretty good crowd in the stands. The pits were absolutely full. The race cars and the cars and trucks associated with all of them, there was no room left in the infield. So that was excellent. And the hope is, in the aftermath of those two kind of experiments, that they're going to return next year to a monthly. That nothing's been announced, but that's the kind of the understanding that's out there, is running in conjunction with the Fayetteville Speedway.
Now, is Fayetteville do that? I mean, do they run once a month? Or
Fayetteville typically runs on average about three times a month. That there's always at least one vacant weekend. Maybe some months might have two, but Fayetteville does not run continuously. As a matter of fact, at the last Lakeview race, it was the Fayetteville Speedway officiating crew that was doing everything at Lakeview. The flagman, the announcer, the various people were the crew from Fayetteville. So the understanding now is that they're going to run in conjunction. The times that Fayetteville don't run, which is about once a month, they will run at Lakeview, which is, in the current scheme of things, is extremely smart. That is the smartest thing one can do. This old idea of head-to-head and I'll run you out of business, those days are way over.
Yeah, because Dillon runs on Saturday, Myrtle Beach runs on a Saturday night, and Lakeview is running on a Saturday night.
Lakeview's running on a Saturday, Fayetteville's running on a Saturday. I mean, that ideology, I don't know that it ever worked. Even back in the day that we like to think everything was great,
right.
Tracks was coming and going by all the time. Back at the reason we didn't know that they didn't, the slack never come out of the chain, is because one would always open.
Yep.
One would close and one would open, so there was never a net loss. Sometimes two would open. But now, since the likelihood of tracks opening is like zero, there ain't going to be many more racetracks ever built in the. They just it's kind of like golf courses. There ain't going to be many more built, are there, Jeff?
It's true.
They just ain't, and there are not going to be many more racetracks. So we've kind of got what we got.
Yeah,
you better hold on to them.
And if any, the only alternative is just try to work together a symbiotic relationship, and that precludes every single Saturday night.
Right.
That's just a new reality, at least in my opinion. That's I don't know that anything that's really new thinking under the sun. Because we can go back and name many cases where tracks came and went and all that. So the more things change, the more they stay the same. But hopefully it's going to take cooperation among racetracks now to survive, if that is possible, in the new world order.
If they don't, they won't survive. There's no way that it's – and the quicker they come to that realization – The better off everybody's going to be. The fans, the drivers, track owners, promoters, everybody.
Yep.
It came out, I think, since we've been gone, that Motor Mile Speedway up in Virginia, they announced they're not renewing their NASCAR sanction. They didn't exactly say they wouldn't be doing something.
They have a drag strip.
Exactly say what they would. They said they might be doing concerts. They might be doing flea markets. They might be doing fairs. They might be doing any number of things because they got this. Look, I've never been there. It's like an excellent facility.
I've never been to a race there. I did ride out there just to see what the track looked like one time. Radford, Virginia.
Yeah, but they are... that's a case where that's not, it ain't going to be a weekly NASCAR track at least next year, so it's tough to be a racing promoter, and in that case that kind of goes against the grain of what we were just saying earlier. That track has been there a long time. Very long time.
It was
actually the old Pulaski Speedway. In the beginning it was dirt. So it's been there since probably maybe even the late 40s.
Right.
And to go this far and then kind of just...
Have you ever heard Peanut Turman talk about practicing at the old Pulaski Speedway? That cow's in the infield. and when it was dirt, he was out there and he was trying a new engine or something. I can't remember what the story was, but he said he'd go like crazy till he got around to run the first lap, and then he'd have to slow down because of his own dust. He couldn't see.
That's one of the hazards of dirt track racing forever.
It really used to be a real hazard.
Yeah.
But he said there was cows in the infield.
I saw a piece on them, just on the – Darian Watts put up something on Beach Ridge Speedway, and the name was familiar, but I didn't actually know where it was. Beach Ridge Motor Speedway dates back to 1949.
Where is it?
It is in Maine.
Yeah.
It is in Maine. That's an unlikely, but it is still going strong. I mean, it's, you know, it's a rare occasion that worked out good. So it started out as a dirt track and so on. So that, you know, it's like everything. There's success stories here and there, but they're, you know, you got to really work at it and be lucky at the same time to be a racing promoter now.
That's a tough job.
What?
I hear music coming from somewhere.
I hear music coming from somewhere. Oh,
Jeffrey's in there playing with his phone.
Jeff's phone ringing.
Ordering a pizza or something. Yeah, man.
Is that Cody on the line?
No.
Well, Jeff, you need to tell us about your trip.
Took 36 hours to get there and 30 to get back.
Whew.
and was there for nine days, worked my butt off. Went out in the 95, 96, 7-degree heat, 95% humidity for 4, 5, 6 hours. Back to the hotel room, take a shower, take a nap, get up, go do some more every day.
Work with the monkeys.
Yeah, it was a really cool experience. It was very much like attending an Olympic-type event for amateur golfers. It was held at four of the top golf courses in Malaysia. Malaysia has about 200 courses. Beautiful, beautiful, phenomenal golf courses. Kuala Lumpur was a gorgeous, clean, organized city. Not anything like what I expected at all. People really nice. Love the food. What else you want to know? It was good, man. It's a great trip, great experience.
36, do you fly across the Pacific Ocean? Is that the way
you
go?
Yeah, we actually, no. When we left, it was 36 hours from the time I left here till I got to the hotel. So I left here, drove to Charleston, got on a plane, went to JFK, flew from JFK across the Atlantic, up over Iceland, yep. Russia, down through China, and that way into Guangzhou, China, then Guangzhou, China to Kuala Lumpur, and then on the way back, Kuala Lumpur to Guangzhou, and then Guangzhou across the Pacific, up across the Aleutian Islands, Alaska, down through Canada, and that way. So I went completely around the world on those two flights. Pretty cool. But the longest leg was about 16 hours, about 13 coming back, with layovers and all that kind of stuff, though. Long, long time. 13 hours difference there and here. So there it is going on 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Yep.
That messes with your head when you're talking about a different day.
Well, it didn't bother me so much except for when I left. And when I flew out of JFK heading that way, it was at 12:45 a.m. when we got on the plane and headed toward Guangzhou, China for a 16-hour flight. It within no time, I was totally confused. I had no idea what time it was, what day it was. I said, okay, I'm at everybody's mercy. I flew business class. It was really nice. I ate everything they put in front of me for all those hours. it was good. That was a great experience, man. Great experience. Shot a bunch of video, took several thousand photos, and
somebody took your picture messing with a monkey.
Yeah, that was actually me.
Oh.
I did a selfie with a monkey. Yep.
Well, you've done selfies with monkeys on this show.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, I have.
Goats.
And goats.
Yeah, not much difference, you know, monkeys and goats. But that's my story. I've already created the video, and I posted it on Facebook. If anybody wants to see the highlights, it's on my page. But it was a cool time.
What was the weather like up?
Not that beautiful. I mean, it the chance of rain every day, and it rained a few times. But
are they equatorial there?
Yeah, temperatures in the 90s, humidity really high. But it was cool time, man. I had a lot of apprehension going over there. You know, for a dumb hillbilly who's, you know, I didn't know what to expect going into a country that's not predominantly, but about a half Muslim. You know, a lot of
do most of the people there speak English enough to get by?
Yeah, most of them speak a little bit. Some of them speak pretty well, and most of them speak enough to communicate with you.
That's good.
Yeah, most of those countries like that, they speak more than one language.
And English is kind of becoming a universal language.
Yeah. Well, and dollars.
Yeah. That was a cool thing, too. We spent Malaysian ringgits, okay? And a ringgit was, the exchange rate was like 38 to 1.
That's about like India used to be when I went.
Yeah. So, you get on that monorail system, went all the way through the city. You could go all over the city on that thing for pennies. And then we got on the monorail, rode at Central Station, which was a 7-story mall that was phenomenal, and then rode the train up to Batu Caves. All the way up there and all the way back cost me less than $10 on all those fares, you know. I mean, it was easy to get around.
Bobby, y'all had the Bell and Bell banquet this past weekend, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did. Bell's museum.
Mr. Bell's farm and museum.
Yeah.
You have the winners of the
I think
who were the winners this year?
The winners in the pro modified class and basically never defeated ever since we started this class is Jeremy Cumby. He won that pretty convincingly for the whatever year, fourth year in a row, I think I read somewhere. In the modified division, that's a more competitive class. Wes Harrell, which is William Harrell's son, he won that by 2 points over Jason Floyd. 2 points in the sportsman class. You know, something, Jack, you might not know, Jim Wilmore has come out of retirement and is kicking butt now.
I have seen that. I've seen some pictures.
Taking names and kicking
driving one
butt.
Of Pete's
cars.
Yes.
Driving Pete's yes, second sir. Car.
He's driving like
pro. Took him a race to practice in a race to get the feel of the car. He struggled with it the first race, but he has been lighting them up since then.
I like Jim.
Yeah, so Jim has come back. He didn't win that division because he only raced about one time in a Bell and Bell race. He raced twice at Lakeview. But that class was won by Mike Doherty, a guy that had never driven in anything. He's from Sanford area. And Mike Doherty, incidentally, is building a car to take the Daytona for the parade.
Cool.
It is a Cotton Owens tribute car, 38 Dodge number 70, and Mike's car is a rat rod version of that. It's a 38 Dodge coupe with a Hemi, and she's very ratified on the outside.
It's the old 33 car, isn't it?
No, he's got.
No, I'm talking about the one.
The
races.
One that he races is, yeah. But the one that he's taking to Daytona is this old Dodge. And then in the six-cylinder class, getting back to Bell and Bell, Sherman Garris, longtime veteran campaigner, won. But Kyle Bell won several races too this year. He's coming on pretty strong in the Bell and Bell pink car. And in our senior class, this was a feel-good story. An old-time racer from the 60s and 70s, whose name was Carl Smith from the Fayetteville area, somehow learned about us about a year ago.
That must be him calling.
Carl Smith won the senior division.
Cool.
I can remember back in the early days when me and Jim used to talk about possibilities, and one of them was that what about if old timers come back and race with us and so on, and this was that actually happened. I remember Carl Smith racing way
now,
back
now that younger. He's done that, you may have some more as we go through the
well we had
2018
was it at Fayetteville that we had a retired Grand National driver,
yeah, David Boggs. You remember that name? Yeah. He drove a race with us a time or two. And we've got a competitor, Randy Smith, who won the senior class at Lakeview. He was second cousins with Glenn and J.D. McDuffie. Yeah. So we got some old-timey connections here and there.
Sounds like the future looks bright for the Bell & Bell Vintage Modified Series.
Well, it turns out the series is outlasting the tracks. if depending on how all that goes, you know, it's looking better now than
guardedly optimistic.
Yeah. Yep, guardedly optimistic. I don't know. You know. All of the tracks, we don't know how everything's going to shake out right now.
So. Don't know how good our sponsorship will be. Don't know how good the tracks we race on will be, or whether they'll be in operation.
Yeah.
But it seems like we've got a really solid base of racers that are interested in what we're doing. For the most part, they're interested in vintage modified racing as we present it. And that, it don't get no better than that, as far as I'm concerned.
Are there any members of the group thinking about going to Daytona this year for the Vintage Parade on the beach?
There could be some.
Yeah,
good.
There could be some.
There are people that are in the early stages of planning to go. It happens every year.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of them that say, "Well, yeah, that's great," especially the day of last year's parade, but. Yeah, there's several of them that are talking about it. Part of the Sanford group said, "Man, I just love to go, but that's my busiest time of the year." Mm. So you know, you have to sort of take all that with a grain of salt. But I've heard enough people talking about it, and
well, that's always a great time.
Yep.
To go down there.
So. Well, it's a fun time. You get to see people that you haven't seen for a whole year. You get to see race cars that you won't see anywhere else in the country.
This is what Mike says he's almost ready to go to Daytona with.
Cool.
So I've seen bits and pieces. Dargan started promoting the parade. I know it's sometime in February. And, usually around Valentine's Day.
It'd be the week before the Daytona 500.
Yeah.
It'd be the week of the, whatever they call it, race, cup race they have, the championship.
Yeah, it's the, what used to be the Busch Clash.
Yeah, whatever they're calling it.
Yeah.
And the ARCA race is that same night.
Yeah. I can't plan that far in advance, but I would like to go.
I'm planning on going again.
It's fun. I wonder if the Roach Motel is still there.
I for one won't be staying there.
The Roaches are probably 6 inches bigger now.
Yeah, they probably.
No, they was remodeling the RM the last time we was. you stay with us, Jack?
Yeah, one year. Yeah.
Yeah, he stayed in y'all's room the first night. Yeah. He stayed in our room the second night, and we were complaining about how bad it was.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
And Jack told us what a great room we had compared to what he was in the
night
before.
Bobby and Bill had, exactly.
And then the judge was out looking for a hairdryer the next morning, and I was concerned about whether or not the building was going to stand up. The concrete piers that it was built on had big hunks that had fallen out of them.
And it was under renovation.
Yeah. It needed more than renovation on that side we were on. It needed bulldozing and starting over again.
It was ocean front, though.
Yeah.
she'd have been something down. In the 60s.
Yeah.
And speaking of the 60s, the Streamline is open back up in Daytona.
I've seen bits
and
pieces
of it.
I heard
it was going to.
That's
going to
be on my bucket list to check that out this year.
Stay there. Well, I tell you, one of the places we stayed was not far from the Streamline, and it might have been the, because I walked down almost close enough to the Streamline.
Yeah, it was only like a block or two away. I didn't realize it was that close.
Was that the last or the year before? I can't remember. But one of those times we was real close to the Streamline.
Right.
Because I made the trip down to look at it, so for historical purposes, it pretty much looks the same. They've tried to keep it. What was the name of the lounge on the top floor? The Starlight Lounge, or where the famous meetings took place?
Yep,
something like that. So
that sure enough was in the what we look upon now as the heyday of NASCAR racing.
That was prior to the heyday.
Well, the tip of the spear.
Yeah.
Yep, the heyday started there.
Yep. I don't think Big Bill or any of them had any idea what they were really creating when they did that.
No, I'm sure they didn't.
How could you possibly think of what it would become in the 70s, 80s, 90s?
They were just promoting a circus.
Yep.
That was about what it boiled down to.
That's about what it boiled down to.
Yeah.
And Big Bill had the presence of mind to realize that you can't rule it by consensus. It has to be a totalitarian, I'm the boss, the buck stops here, there is no appeal beyond me.
Yeah.
And there's blank pages in the book where I can write the rules as I go.
Got to have some kind of structure. Even
as it turns out, though, he was capable of doing the job. He wasn't a wacko totalitarian. He knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing, or at least he made us all think he did.
So in that case, it worked because he was qualified to do it. So anyway, it is what it is, and it did work.
It was a great ride while it has lasted. We can only just hang on to the edge of it and see where it goes from here.
Yeah, not a whole lot of racing coming up in the next few weeks.
No, unfortunately.
The PRI shows the big thing on the dirt world. The dirt super late model has really been a buzz in the off season. I mean, there's all kind of things. It's got its own silly season going on. And one of the most interesting things, I don't know if you guys remember the name Bobby Pierce, was a kid that almost won the NASCAR truck race at Eldora a couple of times. Bobby Pierce. Anyway, there's a major dirt late model team that operates out of Dunn, North Carolina, the Dunn Benson. Earl Pearson Jr. usually drives it. It's sponsored by Lucas Oil. Anyway, long story short, Earl Pearson left that team just recently, took Lucas sponsorship with him. But the Dunn Benson team has hired Bobby Pierce to replace Earl. He lived in Illinois, he's moving to the Dunn. And their primary sponsor, the new team's primary sponsor, is Campbell University. Campbell University, which is a Baptist affiliated university in Buies Creek, North Carolina, which is in the greater Fayetteville area. But I mean, how do you get a university to sponsor a dirt late model? I mean, I think that speaks volumes. Yeah. Whoever done that?
Yeah.
Must be
a Robert Smalley there somewhere.
Talk about a good salesman.
Yeah, or a butt shot.
But let's hope that it works.
Yeah. Well, there have been cars over the years that have been sponsored by higher venues of higher learning.
Oh, yeah.
This will be interesting
to see. This is very novel, and they haven't announced which series. He'll either be running the Lucas Tour or the World of Outlaws. And then the big events, all of them, but he's going to be running a national series with Campbell University as the primary sponsor.
I've never heard of him.
All right, fellas, it's that time.
Oh, man, I just gone already.
Already?
Got to get on out of here.
Folks, thanks for tuning in. Appreciate it. Appreciate all you guys. As always, we want to say a special thanks to men and women who serve our military. Thank you.
this what you do so that we can do this. Each and every one of you, good night. God bless.
All right.